Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming out, joining us on a Thursday night. It's always a pleasure for me to participate and be invited to speak at the Theosophical Society, an organization that I've admired for many, many years. And it's an honor and a pleasure to be here tonight and talk about karma and social evolution. We're going to look into karma tonight and hopefully rethink some of our concepts about karma and then see how that can impact or change our concepts of social evolution and the future of the world. Since we've mentioned this word evolution, it's probably a good idea to go backwards in time a little bit and see what has happened in the course of the universe. So this is a evolutionary wave theory, started off somewhere about 14 billion years ago with the Big Bang. There's new theories out these days that the energy and light comes from black holes. We won't get into the cosmological principle tonight, but somewhere the source of consciousness converted into light, and that set off a wave. All is wave. And this is the grand wave of evolution, elementary particles, which turned into atoms, which made molecules. And this first initial descent of the wave got to the trough there, and a turning point, materiality, getting ever more complex molecular structures. But how did it move forward? It had to have a miraculous turning point, and thus we got the appearance of life. Plants, which gave the way for animals, and finally human beings. You'll see here there's an interesting structure, phases of seven, the law of seven octaves, which is a universal principle of nature, and really how things move. There are seven colors in the visible spectrum, 7 days of the week, seven chakras in our energy system, seven notes on the Western musical scale, which then repeats itself in the octave. And likewise, this evolutionary wave follows nature's natural course. We get to the top of the wave, again, a miraculous moment, the equivalent of consciousness becoming light. Here, consciousness becomes self-reflective consciousness of the human being. And then the human society goes through its own downward descent into materiality. Once again, hunting and gathering, domestication of animals, establishing city-states, the Industrial Revolution, which gave us a lot of creature comforts, but which also led us to the trough and the predicament we are in today, right at the base of this wave, the trough again of the grand evolutionary scheme. Now, what you'll see here is that the peaks and troughs of the evolutionary wave are the key moments when something totally different emerges. Light, life, consciousness, and now we're at a new trough, a new turning point, which can easily be said, at least from my point of view, that this is the singular moment, the most important moment in all of human history, bar none, and by far the most important. We are in a moment of critical transformation. We know that many of the ways of the past are not sustainable. We can't go on with ever-increasing population, decreasing resources, exploiting our ecosystems, trying to feed ever more people. While the water dries up, the energy sources are depleted, something has to give. We need to transform society to move forward on this wave and back on the spiritual side. As you can see, this is a material descent, spiritual growth of life, a material descent, and now we're crossing that wave trough into a new beginning, the age of transformation, if you will. So that is a background of why it's so important for social transformation, why we are driven to study notions of karma, evolutionary theory. It's not just interesting stuff. It's really a matter of life or death and how we're going to move forward into the future. Because literally, our Earth is on the brink. And we would evidently like to avoid falling into that pit or that trough and move onward and upward. And why is karma so important in this moment of human history? How does it really apply? Well, I'm sure everyone here believes in some form of karma, even if you use it in a different way or a different word, but we know that all of our actions have consequences. And all of our past actions, all of that human civilization leading up to now, carries an immense karmic weight. And that is part of the problem we're suffering from right now. And we have this notion of karma that, you know, it's kind of this domino effect, that it's this accumulation of everything we've done, and if we go into our karma and we set it off, we really have no control, and this whole thing sets into the process, and we become more or less the victims of our karmic circumstances. And this is the way karma has been traditionally understood. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. You know, what goes around comes around. The golden rule, there are consequences for everything we do. Well, of course there are. The classical sense of karma, then, is the field, and I'm going to talk tonight about the field, because karma is a field. It's the karmic field. And it's a sense of probabilities for action. But that doesn't mean that our action is based exclusively on that field and is dictated by the field. And in fact, there are quite a few possibilities to break out of that. When I talk about a field, let's consider, for example, gravity. Gravity is a field. We're all very familiar with it. The Earth has its gravity, and it has its gravitational field. Here's the Earth. There's a certain amount of distance where we're going to be attracted and pulled back into the Earth by its gravitational field until we kind of reach a point where it balances out. And then beyond that, we lose the pull of the Earth. But the field is still there. It's just become weaker. Likewise, karma, every action we take in life, whether it's an overt action, it's a thought, it's will, it's intention, it creates a wave. It sets off a wave, just like our evolutionary wave, yes, on a much smaller scale, but that wave contributes and makes a field, a physical field of electromagnetic forces. And when we talk about karma and you think, how do we really reconcile the past? What is the mechanism that makes this happen? It's a field force. It's like the gravitational pull of our own actions from the past. But as I've been saying all along, we are not quite as limited as the classical notion of karma would have us believe. So I'd like to talk here a little bit about the karmic shift, going from an idea of billiard balls to probability waves. Newtonian physics, it allowed the Industrial Revolution to happen because we really figured out how mechanical processes work. And one of the great laws of physics is for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. You hit a billiard ball, it hits another ball, that ball bounces. There is this mechanical force that you can measure. And in pure reductionist materialistic paradigm, you know, Laplace once thought that if he had all the formulas and all the statistics and enough data, he didn't need God or consciousness. The universe was like one large machine, and he could predict everything. Well, that didn't work out very well, and we now realize that we have gone well beyond the notion of the universe as a machine, and likewise our notion of karma as a machine dictating us also is now outmoded in our thinking. We now have quantum physics to deal with, which has transformed our view on physics, on physical reality, the nature of consciousness. In quantum physics, we create our reality by collapsing a wave function. Very briefly, in the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty, that means that the essential nature of reality is a wave, as I've said. But we know also that those waves will become particles, and particles become material reality. Now, if we have a quantum field in the laboratory, what determines whether it's a wave or a particle? This great uncertainty. The only thing we know so far that makes that difference is our consciousness. If the technician in the lab wants to find a wave and sets out to measure the velocity of the wave and how fast it's moving through space, that's what it is. If, on the other hand, they want to measure a particle in place and time with rest and mass, it becomes a particle. And it's really what the physicist measures. So this quantum conundrum, and it's caused a lot of trouble for classical physicists, because even Einstein himself was so perplexed by this that he said he couldn't believe that God played dice with the universe. Well, God isn't playing dice with the universe. The universe is giving us the chance to influence the role of our own dice. And with our use of our own consciousness, our intention, we can have an influence on the outcome of the role of the dice or our own future, and in today's lecture, karma. So we're going to move beyond this idea of for every act, there's an equal and opposite action. It's true to some extent, but on the level of consciousness that really produces reality, there's an immense field out there, not only of probabilities, but of potential reality that we can tap into and change or reprogram our karma so that we're not strictly the victims of our own circumstances and our own actions, but we are the programmers and creators of our karmic future. And of course, one of the reasons this is critically important, you know, most people will use karma in a rather negative sense. How many times have you heard or seen something go slightly wrong, an accident happens, whatever, somebody says, it must have been my karma. So we think about it as this past action carrying through with its consequences. Somebody else shot the billiard ball and I just got hit by it, and so I bounce in that direction. That's my karma. Well, if that is exclusively the case, and we think about the history of humanity, I mean, let's face it, it's been rather brutal. The history of humanity has basically been the history of war, conflict, brutal behavior, civilization after civilization throughout history. And if there's only a classical concept of karma needing to pay for the consequences of all that action, then there would be an immense negative balance or baggage of bad karma. But that's not the case, because karma is a wave field phenomena, and it doesn't hold huge positive or negative balances. All field forces in nature seek equilibrium. They want to be in balance. Karma as a whole balances itself out. So really, on a quantum level, no one here, no one anywhere has a negative balance of karma. So when we think about individuals, groups, large groups who may assume that there's some kind of negative balance of karma out there for them or from others. That's simply their interpretation of this classical historical baggage and really has very little to do with the future potential of what karma could be. So let's redefine karma to some extent. Intentions and affirmations are key components in defining karma. It's not simply being the victim, the reaction to this gravitational field of the past. We can set intentions. We affirm something in the present tense, but in the future, I am different. I am transformed. I will do this. I intend to do that. I will be a better person. All of those kinds of things affect the karmic field, and they're very, very important. They're always important even in the actions we take. Just for an example, a car hits a pedestrian and badly injures the person on the street. What are the consequences for the driver of the car? What is that driver's karma? Well, when the driver goes to court, it's really going to depend on what the intentions were, or if there were intentions. Did the driver swerve out of the way to intentionally run down a pedestrian? In that case, they're probably going to go to jail for the rest of their life. Or was it basically an accident? They were distracted or something, and there was no intention at all. Then they're probably going to get a fine, and everything's going to be okay. So the intention, the act of willful intention or lack thereof, changes not only our karma, our whole judicial system is based on this. The world as a whole recognizes the will and intention we put into everything and everything we've done. And likewise, that will and intention going forward is equally powerful to the extent that it overrules the act itself. It's more about the intention and the will involved than actually what happened in and of itself. So we consider the fields past, present, and above all, future in shaping our karma. And as we've said, in the classical sense, we think about it as this tight gravitational field, the attractor of karma. We're pulled into the past. Everything we've done in the past or in past lives, that's our karma. But the field is limitless. And we're on the border of that gravitational karmic attractor in the present moment. We don't have to be pulled into the past. And we can actually generate the capacity to move out of the power of that field and into the potentiality of the future. When the great spiritual traditions say, live in the present moment, the here and now, that's the source of enlightenment or understanding. It was very true in many ways because the present moment, being on that perimeter, if we're really there, we're not dwelling in the past. We're not feeling like we're the victims of our actions. And sometimes if we go out into the future, it's more about worrying about the future than programming the future. You know, I'm worried about tomorrow. Will the government shut down again or be open? How will that affect my stock portfolio? Will I get fired tomorrow because of that? Blah, blah, blah. And we go on and on and on. And so usually we're wavering between sort of worrying, regretting the past that we can't do anything about, or projecting that anxiety into the future, which we actually can do something about, but as long as we're kind of worrying about it, we're not going to do much about it. So thus, the emphasis on being here now. Just concentrate on the here and now. Well, that's fine, and that does give us a little bit of release, but I would say go beyond that point. Go into the real potential of the future. And here we see a difference between probability and potential. The probability is the very close future of our karmic field. If you live here in Wheaton, Illinois, and you have a job as an executive in an office, and you do that every day, the probability that you will get up tomorrow morning at 7:30 and go to work is very, very high. It's probably 99%. And likewise with most of the stuff in your life, the probability that you might go to Chicago to visit a museum this weekend is much higher than your visiting the Amazon rainforest, just because it's closer, it's real, it's part of what you are. These are all probability fields. But beyond the probability is the field of potentiality. And that is limitless. It goes out into the infinite sphere of space. And if we push ourselves beyond that, maybe, if you take this seriously enough, maybe the probability of going out tomorrow to the same old place, the same old job, or the same old routine, if you listen to me talk too long, maybe that'll change. I don't want to convince you right away to quit your job, grab a backpack, and travel off to India, but we could give it some consideration here. Let's expand the potential of our future karma. And let's allow ourselves to take a voyage out there into outer space and consider what our potential is. Because it's all the same field. And that is potentially your karma. And you can go out there and play with it. And you can think, you know, I don't want to be an office executive. I always wanted to be a painter or a free thought thinker or a violinist or whatever it may be. And you begin to think, you know, it's not totally impossible. I got enough savings. I can paint pretty well. I could do a few pictures. And you start expanding this potential. And when you do that, all of a sudden you realize that you're not the victim of everything that always happened in the past that's making you and locking you into this life here and now, that you also have that outward expansion where you can expand on your potential, entertain it, visualize it, and maybe set some intentions and affirmations. You know what? I'm going to go there. I'm going to see that. I'm going to make that happen. And that has nothing to do, or very little to do, with any of that attractor, gravitational, karmic field of your past. That is pure potential future. And that is what we need to visualize together to move through this wave trough as a global society. How do we really put this practice to work, of this new definition of karma, other than daring to imagine that something might be different tomorrow morning? Well, first of all, let's look a little more closely at some of that past karmic field, and let's break it down a little bit, because there are two different basic kinds of karma: individual karma and collective karma. I'd like to talk first about collective karma, because this is closer to being a no-brainer as to how much we can really do about it. We are all born into what are essentially karmic groups. So when you come out of the womb kicking and screaming, first of all, you're a gender. So you're either male or female. Now, that's going to be karma for the rest of your life. It's going to affect you. Then you have a race. The people around you, your parents, have a religion, an ethnicity, a language, culture, all of these kinds of things. And so you're born into that. And then, to make matters worse, society's number one mission in life is to brainwash you to believe all that. Socialization, cultural conditioning. From the moment you can hear, speak, begin to think, you are told that you're a white, male, Midwestern, American, English-speaking, and the stream of identity groups that's piled upon you is almost endless. Or you can be a black, African, Muslim. It doesn't matter, but wherever we are, we're going to be culturally conditioned to know, accept, embrace, and defend all of that karmic identity. Well, the problem is then we reach a certain age and we get so locked into that that we then identify with what we feel is all the karmic baggage of that group. So, you know, let's say I'm Jewish and we've suffered and we've fought with the Arabs for millennia and everybody's persecuted and oh my gosh, I've got all that karmic weight on me because I'm Jewish. Or I'm Muslim and I'm Arab and I hate the Jews and they've always tried to be the aggressors on us, and you identify with all that stuff and it becomes so real that it affects everything you do, think, and feel to the point that it solidifies in your heart and soul, and that's who you are, and that's what your karma becomes. And we end up hating or despising other people just because of this over-identification with some group that, okay, maybe we happen to be born into it, and maybe there was some karmic effect from previous incarnations that put us there. But we can stop and think about this and say, well, let me do away with all those groups for a minute. Let me expand that group in the same way that we expanded our potential. And say, well, it might be true that I'm male, white, Midwestern, American, all the rest. But then I could say, I'm a global citizen. I'm part of all humanity. I love all people, no matter what their karmic groups are. We are part of the holistic humans of the human community, and we're all in this together. And the minute you expand that, then all of a sudden, all those karmic grievances that your group might have suddenly don't seem to be quite so important. And isn't the survival of civilization, the peace of planet Earth, the welfare of the planet, the survival of the ecosystems, all these big potential issues, isn't that what our karma really is? And the future of tomorrow, it's going to be, can we control the population? Can we have clean, safe drinking water to grow our crops and quench our thirst? Can we have clean air to breathe? Can we have a more equitable distribution of resources so that we share and we eradicate poverty and we give education to everyone? And as we start to change this perspective, our karma, our group identification, all that socialization that our culture worked so hard to condition us, it begins to break down. And we become global citizens, holistic humans, working together beyond the borders of our groups, fusing groups, making them ever larger. And you know what happens? That past karmic field disintegrates. It's no longer there. There's no negative baggage. We don't have to hate any other group. We don't have to carry any grievances about anything or anybody. anytime, we can be free. We don't have to associate with that. And it's a simple choice. Now, granted, it's not easy to carry it through because our whole life we've been conditioned to firmly believe that. And going back to this evolutionary journey, the reason is because of evolutionary survival. In the early stages of human history, we were conditioned to protect the group. You know, whether it was the family, the clan, or whatever, we don't want to lose the war with the neighboring clan, and so we were socialized into this for survival. But the groups have expanded, the world's expanded, our consciousness has expanded, and we're no longer in the need to bond together for that kind of survival. The survival is actually out there now. The survival is on a very large, huge plane, and that's what bonds us together as a whole planet to protect our ecosystem, to create peace on Earth, to work together, to cooperate. That's what's going to influence our survival, not some little tribal community or family worrying about the next door neighbors. It's a global, holistic issue beyond any collective group other than the oneness of humanity. And that's how we get rid of most of our karmic baggage. And that's why there is an equilibrium of karma in the world. Because in the field of consciousness and karma, it doesn't weigh those things out. It doesn't belong to any groups. It's the whole. It's an equilibrium. There is true balance there. So as a group, it's a matter of each individual thinking, I don't really have to over-identify with that group anymore. I can be the big group, the big idea, the big cause. Now on an individual level, it becomes a little more complex. How do we do this same trick on an individual basis? Because this is where it gets tricky in the sense that if we've committed a misdeed in the past, that is real. That is the golden rule. That's what makes sense out of everything that's happening. That's why reincarnation works and why we carry our individual baggage with us. And that is not so easily dispersed as our collective karma. We can't just go blithely away and say, well, you know, I once hit my best friend in the nose because we were having a silly argument and we drank too many beers. And, well, tough luck. I'm going to drop that. I'm not going to carry that with me. Well, if you punched your best friend in the nose, that does have karmic consequences. And if you want to clear that part of the field attractor out, if you can find your best friend and apologize for it, that's a good move. If you can't locate your friend, you can meditate on it, put it out there, give gratitude to the universe, say you're sorry, give goodwill. You can volunteer for a nonviolence campaign or help battered women to compensate for your own violence in the past. But you really do have to do something. It's not just flipping the program switch as our collective karma is. One does need to make some kind of compensation or change in their individual behavior or intention or affirmation to clear up their individual karma. But it can be done. And I think most of us do it all the time. We do something silly, the next day we think about it, say, I'm really sorry I did that. I'm going to apologize to the person. I'm going to make up for it. I'm going to do some extra work. So we're constantly cleansing also our individual karmic field. This is the kind of work that the evolution of consciousness is all about. It's healing the field on a collective basis, by eradicating these group separations, and on an individual basis, by making the nature of our consciousness pure, cleansed, healthy. And the nature of the field is just that. It's not full of black stains, negative karma, baggage of all that stuff. The field's in its pure state of equilibrium. It's only us as individuals with our perception of where we are in the field, how sucked into it we are, how much of victims of our past are we, or how much are we the creators of our potential reality. If we want to see that mass, heavy particle of our past as who we are, we create it. We can measure it. It's got plenty of mass. It's weighty. It's there. We want to see ourselves as a wave flying into the future with speed and velocity and the height of consciousness, taking us out there to the limits of our potential. We do that. We are that. We create it. That's the quantum nature. We make the wave function what it is. That's the power of consciousness. That's what changes our karma. So as we move forward in this new concept of the karmic shift, then it's kind of a good thing to go back and say, well, what really created this to begin with? You know, we're so classically oriented to think that it's cause and effect, the domino effect. I did one thing, those dominoes happen the rest of my life, they keep causing other things to happen. I'm the end of this chain reaction. I'm the billiard ball that got hit by another one, etc., etc. Because I am suffering from the causes of all that stuff. But, you know, in the classical sense, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Got to have one to get the other. And likewise with the karmic field, which came first, the cause or the effect? Maybe the effect comes before the cause. Maybe the effect is what makes things happen and becomes the new cause. Maybe the Big Bang or the black hole or the energy source, when it burst into being, maybe that was just an effect. Maybe the field of consciousness felt so much energy, so much light, I'm just going to be the universe. And the effect of that feeling then caused the universe to happen. And likewise with us, and when we get up tomorrow morning and we think about all the things that caused us to be here and do what we're doing now, you know, it caused me to set my alarm for 7:30 to get up to brush my teeth, and I'm just the reverberating effect of all those causes. Or you can get up in the morning and say, I'm going to change the routine. I'm going to flip it around. I'm going to affect a new cause. I'm going to sit up here. I'm going to start the day by meditating. I'm going to visualize a new future for myself. I'm going to think about the potential reality that I have the power to create and that I believe in, and I know I am that future, because the effect in me is so powerful, it's going to cause all that to change. And what we see here, the cause and the effect, it's just a matter of perception. It's just which side of the coin are you looking at? We're not the victims of all those causes. We can be the effect that causes the change, that starts the chain reaction and the future domino effect to build consciousness, change the world, alleviate the karmic burden, open the boundaries of potentiality to their limitless horizons of what we can do together, if we think that's what it's going to be. And it is that easy and powerful. Just to take another example, not only in quantum physics, but in cellular biology, we now know too that we are not the effect of the cause. You know, in the 1950s, Watson and Crick discovered DNA and genes. And all of us in our biology classes in high school were probably told, you are the result of your genes. So you're tall, short, black, white, all the stuff you are because of your genes. And that dictated what you are. And that gene pool then is back in the center of gravity, and that's your karma. And you know what? You can't do much about it because it's your genes. Well, in cutting-edge cellular biology of today, that is actually not true. Bruce Lipton has written numerous books, The Biology of Belief, Spontaneous Evolution, and his new book just out, The Honeymoon Effect. What he did early, back in the late 60s, early 70s, as a cellular biologist, he did some of the first experiments with stem cells, and he cloned a stem cell. So he started with one cell and made identical cells. So all of those cells were genetically identical, okay? But then he took them and he put them in different cultures to see what would happen. And one stem cell turned into muscle tissue. And one stem cell turned into fat. And another one turned into bone. What made the identical stem cell what it was? It wasn't its genes, because all the genes were the same. It was the environment, the culture in which it grew. And if we change the environment, or we change our culture, we change what we become. So the gene pool that we have is only that tight probability field. But the actual manifestation of what we become is our interpretation of the environment, our perception of that. It's what our mind thinks the environment is. We're a lot more powerful than those stem cells because they could only absorb the culture as to what it was they were growing up into. But the power of our minds can literally change that culture. We can say, I'm not Arab, I'm Jewish, because I just made that decision in my mind. And then we are, and we change it. And we become something totally different. And it doesn't matter what kind of genes we had. We create our own cellular biology. The cell does it because it reads the environment as it comes through the cell membrane. The cell membrane is really the brain of everything. And it will change the nature of the cell and whether it's healthy or not just by the environment it's reading. And if our cells do that every day, just think what the power of our mind can do to change who and what we will become by the environment we put ourselves in, and then above that, the perception of that environment. Now, it could be a rainy day tomorrow, and somebody might think, that's horrible. I hate the rain. It's cold. I'm getting all wet. What an ugly day. I'm going to stay in bed. Or you can say, well, I'm a farmer, or I'm a nature lover, and it's been a little dry, and I just love the rain. I love the smell on the grass, and it's going to make the flowers grow, and it's a beautiful day, and I'm going to go out and sing in the rain. It's the same environment. What change did to being a miserable day where you're curled up in a corner, depressed, or you're out singing in the rain? It's your perception of the day. And that's the same perception of our karma. We can let the collective groups go in the past. We can make amends for our individual transgressions. We can move not only into the present, but into the potential future and make that our perception of who we could potentially be and make that our reality. And all of a sudden, this whole complex heavyweight of our karma is gone. And here we are, a new cell with a new life and a new mind to become what we want to be, who we need to be, and above all, how we will best serve humanity in the transformation of consciousness and the social evolution we need to overcome the challenges and difficulties of these times. And as a result, we effect a new cause. The cause literally to save the world, to save the human experiment, to work together. We effect that basically through the power of love. Love is the strongest driving force. It is the evolutionary impulse of consciousness that pushes that wave forward. And suddenly we make a new effect. I love the world. I love my neighbors. I love the other countries. I love everybody. We're all in this together. How couldn't we love anybody else? It's our large group problem. And the only thing we've got to combat it with is love. And when we understand that, karma, this great burden of history, perhaps the great burden of tens, hundreds of lives we've lived before, how do we stop the cycle? How do we break out of the routine? How do we make tomorrow a totally different day with infinite potential? We reach out to others. And we put this concept into action. Tomorrow, I am going to do something different to reach out and help others. And not only eradicate my past karma, but to create this immense potential in the future of all kinds of good karma. I'm going to expand the field. I'm going to be a rocket of consciousness going as far out there as I can, helping as many people as I can through social action to heal the field, spread the love, and change the trajectory of human society. So that's how our karma does fit into social evolution. It is our karma to understand this on a very deep, collective, and personal level, and then all of a sudden create a new karma. The karma of this world is not to suffer in war and deprivation and poverty and retribution and starvation. That's not our karma. Our karma is to live in peace, harmony, equitable distribution of psychological and physical resources, loving one another, moving forward together as holistic humans into a very bright, promising spiritual future. So I hope I've generated a few thoughts, some questions, and I'd like to open this up to questions at this time.
I don't believe that, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that you're talking about Abraham and Edith Hicks kind of law of attraction. It seems very different because you're saying we need to perceive differently and then start acting differently. Would you say that's true for what you're saying?
I would say that's true. And I don't necessarily want to talk down the notion of the law of attraction here, but rather emphasize the law of expansion, if you will, of increasing potentiality, not worrying about the past or what we want. The thing with the law of attraction that's always bothered me is it's kind of building on desire. It's kind of the same old problem. I want this, therefore I'm going to get it. Well, yeah, that happens. But it's mostly a material base. And we're talking about a spiritual aspiration here. So what's attracting us is the outer limits of the field in an expanding universe of consciousness. Thanks. That's a good question. More questions?
On the question of collective karma, it's one thing to say, I'm going to handle that. But it has its own power as well, doesn't it, to fight back?
Absolutely. And so I made it sound pretty quick, easy, simple, fixed solution here. So thank you for mentioning that, because it's definitely not that easy and simple. And it's something we have to practice every day throughout our lives. But it really comes down to getting in touch with who we really are, our innate essence as a holistic human being, and finding something new to identify with. You know, it's hard to go out there cold turkey, willy-nilly, with no cultural baggage. We all need some support systems. So you can't just abandon it all from one day to the next, but you can work on it. For example, in my own example, you know, I was born a white male Midwesterner in a conservative rural community of Illinois. And most of my family and my distant relations and cousins and all that kind of stuff, they're still there. That's their world. Now, if I go out there and visit with them, and the subject of discussion turns to politics or gun control, and they want to show me their new rifle that they just bought last week, I'm not going to go there, you know? I'm just going to say, you know what? I'm nonviolent. I think we should ban all weapons. I don't want to see your gun. I don't want to hear about your political view on this. That's not part of my identity, with all due respect. So anybody want to join me and we'll go out in the field and pick flowers together? Okay? So those are the kinds of choices one can make politely, correctly, but firmly, saying, that's not my identity. Okay, I was born there. You're my family. You're my number one support group in early life. I don't deny you, but I've expanded, you know, and it's different now. And we can do that with all kinds of examples all the time on a daily basis. And the first time, maybe just a little bit of an expansion. Next time, you know, I got there. I got, instead of looking at their guns, I got them out in the field picking flowers. So the next time, now let's go out in the field and sit around in a circle and talk about a beautiful day. And then the next time, hey, let's go out there and meditate, you know. And you can make it grow and happen. But it is a process. The wave takes a while. It won't happen from one day to the next. So thank you for bringing that up, because it's not as easy as it sounds. More questions?
I'll get to you in a minute. Yes.
There have been societies or tribes who, Native American cultures that kind of practice that, especially when you talk about eradicating poverty and education. With the idea that, you know, when what's enough, you talked about desire and materialism, and, you know, the idea that when everybody has what they need, that's enough. But these societies have, you know, there are little pockets, they exist, maybe still today, but they come and go. You know, there have been these pockets, these examples have happened. I know we need to be those, start those, you know, little pockets again? Or how do we explain what happened to those people then?
Can you define the question just a little bit more for me before I...
Well, there have been groups that have tried to, you know, their view of karma or their collective karma group identity has been more encompassing.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't exist anymore. They were overpowered by our materialistic, you know, colonization.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we need to get back to that idea.
We do. Yes, we do.
So
I think what you're saying is, if that didn't work before, why is it going to work now? If we had Native Americans respecting all nature, and we had Central Africans embracing I am what I am because of who we are, and we had these holistic Aboriginal philosophies of the oneness of being, and they got squashed by the bulldozer of material reality, how's it going to be different this time? Is that more or less what you're saying? Well, what I would say is, because it's going to be different because of the shift, because we are at that wave trough now, and the new emergent values that are going to last and gain priority are based on real spirituality. They're not based on the material law of attraction or the accumulation of wealth or goodness. Yes, we all have to have what we need. I mean, we need shelter, and we need food, and we need psychological comfort, and that is a varying scale. But in the Western world, the vast majority of us have that. And a lot of us are now learning, you know what, buying the bigger house on the next block and spending an extra $100,000 to do so, it didn't give me that return and happiness. It gave me higher insurance bills, more stuff to worry about, all the rest. And that is becoming very, very prevalent now, that more materiality isn't the source of happiness. And it's not what we're aspiring to on any hierarchy of needs. What we need is inner spiritual knowledge, and yes, satisfaction, that we're doing our part in the whole to make this sustainable. And so there's a new value system that's arising as the old value system declines. And it's this shift in values that's going to make the difference and sustain it and give new groups the respect and staying power that they didn't have before.
I see that a lot of our darkness has come up. We're seeing all the darkness from all these years. And boy, I got real upset about that, and I was doing a lot of activism, and this just kept me in a kind of a chicken little state. And then I'm also a very spiritual person, so I was struggling, which way am I going to go? And then I saw Brené Brown's work on shame, how Americans are individually driven by shame, and we feel isolated, we feel less than, we try to be more than. And then I encountered Kristen Neff's work on self-compassion, and then there's nonviolent communication. All these are areas that I want to work in, because I think that individual by individual, we need to deal with what we have, what's in our consciousness that no longer belongs there. And we need to realize that everyone has very similar feelings of shame about something. And once you realize that and realize that you don't have to be better than other people to be accepted, then you can see, oh, then I'm like everyone else, and we can all work together. This is kind of my mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Brené Brown's idea of shame and all that, it's interesting. I was actually just watching one of her TED Talks the other night. To some extent, I agree with her. So, to some extent, I would take a little bit of an issue. First of all, Americans have no monopoly on shame. It's a worldwide phenomena. And why is it a worldwide phenomena? Why is there this lingering shame? It goes back to the wave, because the wave, it hit the peak where we were all one. And that's when the dawn of human consciousness happened. And then right after that, what happened? It's a descent into materiality. That is the way the evolutionary wave goes. That was in our consciousness and translated or transmuted into the collective psyche as a fall from grace. And therefore, almost all of our spiritual traditions, our mythologies, our creation stories involve a fall from grace. You know, Satan tempted Eve and she became a sinner, and we're sinners and we've fallen. And that's where the shame comes from. But just like that assumed collective baggage, it's false. That is not true. What happened? Yes, there was a fall. It was the natural flow of the wave into materiality. And yes, it was a breaking away of oneness. And why? Because we gained self-reflective consciousness. You know, before we had that, we were all one. We couldn't think, well, my name is Judy, Bill, Tom, and I'm different. I mean, we sensed that, but we were just a bunch of primates kind of working together for survival. And then all of a sudden, I think, therefore I am, and therefore I'm different from the next person, and I'm an individual, separate self. I'm no longer part of the whole oneness. And that's what happened to us. And that has been our psychic human drama ever since. And that's why we feel shame, because we know we started in that oneness, and we're not part of it now. But it's not our fault. And we're not sinners, and we haven't done anything wrong. It's just the way evolution goes. So now as we hit the trough, all of that comes clear too. We realize that's just the material descent of evolution, the structure of that downward ride that separated us from oneness, that maybe made us beat up or overcome or cause genocide to all those individual pure groups. We did that as collective humanity, but we don't need to be feeling shameful about it. We just need to move on, gain the force of spirit, and move up the other side of the wave. Yeah.
There is another question. Yeah, do you want to follow on?
Respond to that. I'm not implying that the shame is real.
Uh-huh.
And you have not listened to Kristen Neff on self-compassion, or do you know about nonviolent communication? Do you know about either one of those areas?
Mm-hmm.
You do?
I think so.
Okay. Shame is not real, but it's our perception, and that's what I want to work with.
That's what I've been saying all along.
Okay, so we're on the same page. I just want to make clear.
Yeah, it's just our perception of that. Well, it's the same thing of what we were talking. It's a process. You have to start to work on it to slowly change that perception. Question back here?
Yes, there's another question.
Mine is less of a question and more of a comment. And really, I'm very excited about many of the things you're saying here tonight. First, I really like this idea that was brought up of one person making the choices that then spreads outward. You know, that one person can start doing something and then this can collectively take on a bigger form in the world. And then you were also talking about making repairs or doing something nice for someone when you hurt them. Mm-hmm. And that really resonated with me because I work with families with discipline and parenting, and that's what we're teaching them now with their children, is that when they mess up, instead of putting them in the corner or making them write a letter, they actively do something, whether it's their friend or their sibling or their parent, to make a repair and do something nice for them to make it up. And as we're talking about one person making a difference, and I see all these families doing that, I'm kind of excited about this new generation and what it might look like and how these kids are going to act in 20, 30 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a great example of the karmic shift. So, you know, as parents, we don't have to make them pay for their misdeeds. We just need them to clean it up, you know? So you did that, go say you're sorry, now go do something nice, help it out. And in the end, we're better off than we were before. And the individual act of doing that does create this ripple effect of setting a good example, of being the effect that will cause others to change. So it really does propel itself in that manner. So thank you for that observation. Do we have time for one last question? Yes.
At what point did you start to expand your consciousness? Was there a major event or something in your life?
There are major events in all our lives. They're on the waves, you know, and we hit peaks and troughs in our own individual evolution of consciousness. Oftentimes we're not aware of what's going on, that we're in a peak or a trough, and we kind of miss the opportunity. So when you're in a trough, you know, rather than getting down and depressed and, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do, and everything's dark, night of the soul, and I don't know what to do, it's terrible, you know, say, wait a minute, this is an opportunity for a new beginning. I'm in a trough because life put me there, but I know that the wave is going to turn if I can just kind of pull it together and change this. You know, this wave theory of troughs and octaves, the philosopher Gurdjieff was one of the first ones to delineate this, and he talked about these troughs and these intervals. And actually, in the octave, when it hits the interval, the acceleration of change actually physically slows down. That's the interval, that's the trough that we can't get through. And Gurdjieff said, when you hit that, what you need is a shock to push you through. And if you know, life will provide that shock, but if you're really good, you can provide your own shock. You know, you can self-instill it. I need a boost. I need to change something. And if you can sense that in the trough, and it's much more important, the deep, deep change, transformative moments are more in the troughs than they are in the peaks. That's when life came into being. That's what we're talking about now. The peak, you know, we're so developed in Western society to have peak experiences. We want to get high. We want to get high on this. We want to find that. That's almost this material attraction thing again. When you hit the peak, it's like, now I need to understand why I got here and be grateful for it and understand it and kind of look back and not revel in, I just want to get higher. It's how I'm going to use this. So if you can understand these peaks and troughs to your own advantage and listen to them in key moments in your life, that's what really accelerates your own change. There have been many of those in my life. I don't think I want to tell too many personal anecdotes, but rather put it into some kind of symbolism that maybe works for all of you. There's one psychological theory I like very much. It's called the kicking the card table theory, that, you know, if we take an analogy for life, that in life we're given one of those old folding rickety card tables and a deck of cards. And our purpose in life is to set the card table up and arrange the cards on the table, okay? So most people, when they get the card table set up and they got it there, then they're at their peak. And they go, wow, I've really got a great table of cards here, man. And I'm just going to sit back and admire my cards for the rest of my life, okay? Well, then you don't go anywhere, and that gets real boring later on. And so psychologically, evolutionary, social evolution thinking, what you do at the moment that you've got your card table all perfectly set up is you give it a good swift kick on one corner, set the cards flying, knock the table down, and then you give yourself the privilege of starting all over again and building something new. And although it sounds pretty crazy, and sometimes you end up doing those things and you think, why on earth did I do that? And I've done a few card table kicks in my time that I just thought, what was I thinking? And in the end, in retrospect, those were the key moments of my life that set me on a new, better path just because I had the insanity to knock it all down and start over. So I hope that's more applicable to everyone else than telling any personal anecdotes.